Hello, and welcome to Coop for Cats with me, Amy Hughes. We're inviting you in for black coffee and a chat about our favorite band, Squeeze. In this episode, I'm welcoming David Bailey, well known to the Squeeze community. Hello, David. How are you?
Hi, Amy. Well, that's very kind of you. I'm fine. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm extremely happy to have you on the podcast for many reasons, but most notably, there are so many people out there who say that they're Squeeze fans, have worked with Squeeze, who have worn many hats with the band, and I think you're probably one of those individuals. So I'm super happy that in my Squeezedom, and I can go back many, many years, it's nice to get a lot of people who just say, yeah, you know, nobody really says no when I talk about Squeeze. They're just like, yes, I'm there. And I've said that many times on the podcast when I ask people. So for everybody out there who is not intimately familiar with David and his associations with Squeeze, David, I'll let you kind of sort of take charge and tell us what your history is with the band.
Sure. Well, as far as I'm concerned, I'm just another fan. So it's an irrelevance when you got into Squeeze, as long as you're into them now. It doesn't matter whether you've even heard all of the albums. You know, you're welcome to come along and enjoy the band, as you know, they belong to everyone. So whenever I'm described as a super fan, I think, well, no, I just like the music like anyone else does. I grew up in a house that had very little music. I'm from the north of England. I grew up poor in a northern mill town. My parents worked in shops, and I went to my local school. And you know, the music that they listened to, my dad was into big band jazz, which, you know, the Venn diagram with my mum sort of overlapped with Shirley Bassey, and she liked Nana Mouskouri and the Carpenters. And her Venn diagram overlapped with my older brother, who liked, you know, Led Zeppelin. But none of that spoke to me. So it was really, you know, when I was 14, February 1978, that I heard Take Me I'm Yours on the transistor radio. And it just blew me away. I'd never heard anything as beautiful and as romantic, anything as brilliantly composed, where, you know, every bar introduced something new, some new delight. The words were superb. And I heard it twice on the little transistor radio and thought, this is the best thing I've ever heard in my life. And as I walked home from school, 3:45 in the afternoon, I thought, well, if I go home and I turn the radio on, and if I hear it again and I still like it, I'm going to walk into town now. I've got my 75p and I'll buy a copy of the single. And I got in, went into the kitchen, turned the little transistor radio on onto Radio 1 on AM, really bad quality broadcast. And there was not a single word of introduction, just the very first opening bar of Take Me I'm Yours started. And I wasn't able to sit down. I just stood there looking at the radio, thinking, music will never be as exciting in my life as this. This is the greatest thing I've ever heard. So I walked into town to the Golden Disc, spent 75p, brought it home. And that's really a start of a lifetime of loving, you know, music with, you know, too many words and you can't really hum the tunes, which is how I like to describe the music of Squeeze to people who've never heard anything by the band.
Let me ask you, being there and experiencing it for the first time, what do you feel, in your opinion now, made that such a revelation to you? Was it what was going on in the top pop era of that time that just didn't really speak to you? Sort of like give me a back history of what was going on. And then this comes out, this song comes out, and you're mesmerized. You're hooked. So yeah. What kind of was going on?
Well, I'd been too young, really, for fully-fledged punk. You know, the Sex Pistols just seemed so angry and uncouth. I didn't get them at that time. You know, I was waiting. I was primed. I was ready for some music that spoke to me. And, you know, the things I loved were anything that was storytelling. I loved anecdotes. I loved, you know, long, convoluted jokes. I went to the library every week with my mum when I was small and, you know, loved storybooks. She taught me to read before I went to school. So it was, you know, I was primed for storytelling, for something which was modern and exciting, that wasn't, you know, old hat like my, you know, parents and my brother loved. And, you know, Squeeze just hit all of the boxes for me. And I don't know, I went to the Museum of the Home over Christmas with my girlfriend, and they had something written on the wall there. I took a photo of it, and it really sums up how I feel about Squeeze. The quote's from Jude Rogers, and she said, "Familiar songs take us back to our earliest years and do it quickly. In 2009, a Czech American neuroscientist, Petr Janáta, ran a study that proved that reactions to pieces of familiar music happened in the same part of our brains as the processing of our sense of self." And I thought, there, that's me. You know, it's not just that I like Squeeze. Squeeze have become part of, you know, the very nature of who I am. They're embedded in my brain. They're part of my personality. You know, so if, like, I got two friends I go cycling with every week, and one, my neighbour, likes the band, has a copy of Argy Bargy. You know, I take him along to the gigs. But my other friend just laughs at the band. You know, he likes music that other people approve of him liking. And that's something I've noticed about Squeeze fans, that they have less susceptibility to social pressure. You know, that need to like bands that other people will approve of is far lower in Squeeze fans. You know, the people I meet like the music they like, and they're not ashamed of it. You know, there's no such thing as a Squeeze fan with a guilty pleasure. You know, we love our pleasures, and we're unashamed of them. So yeah, I think Squeeze are part of, you know, have become part of my personality. It's something very deep seated.
I would agree with that, because it feels like you can leave them for a long, long time and then come back to them and realize, well, this was the reason. I mean, I'm talking, you could leave them for 10 years and remember them in your mind, in your memory, and why did I hook up with this band? What gave me so much enjoyment? And then come back to them, which I feel like right now for me personally is where I am, where I hooked onto them like you did. I kind of left music, you know, for a long, long time, and then went to see them in 2021. And that's when I had like this epiphany. I'm like, I still like this band. I don't care what they're doing, what kind of music they're making. I might have forgotten in the last couple of years, but something is happening here, and I'm not quite sure what it is. And I'm imagining you've met a lot of people who've come in into many different entry points for the band, and then they go back or they go forward. Is that been your sort of history about meeting other Squeeze fans?
Yeah, there's always a slight embarrassment of, you know, I was too young, or I only got into them in 1987. And I always think, well, it's an irrelevance. You know, Squeeze belong to everybody. Nobody's a super fan. You can get in any route you want, and you can like them for any reason that makes sense to you. It's all, you know, intensely personal, I think. There's no, you know, mine's just one route into the band. All routes to squeeze are acceptable.
Well, it's nice when you can also have a, rather say a long history with them. So you could say, hey, I went to see Squeeze in 1981, which is something you have done. And then relate that to somebody who didn't start to see Squeeze until, say, the early 2000s or maybe even just last year, let's put it that way. Do you tend to see that happening a lot nowadays? Do you see a comparison when you go to gigs with friends and say, I remember when they did XYZ date back in the early days?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons why I started the website Packet of Three is because I have such a poor memory. But I have a method, and you know, it's a database. I can put any venue, any city, any dates, and any month, and call up, you know, where I was, what gig I went to. So I know I went to see Squeeze in 1979, and that was really my first proper religious experience. You know, they played "It's So Dirty," my favorite, you know, B-side. And I was just transfixed. You know, I stood there utterly transported. And when Glenn started that guitar solo, it was just, you know, one of the greatest feelings of ecstasy I'd ever had. I just loved the band. And I managed to join the fan club and get a few pen friends, as you did then, with, you know, stamped addressed envelopes to the fan club. And I soon found out that it was Julian's mum who ran the fan club. And I had, you know, quite a few girls and young women who used to write to me. And they were incredibly kind. You know, I went to a boys' school. I had just a brother. And so it was my first experience of meeting girls. Now, I had no idea that they'd be so nice, so kind, so welcoming, so caring, so interested. It was a revelation from, you know, going to school with a whole load of rough bullying boys. I loved it. You know, they'd go and buy me the latest Squeeze badge. They'd go and check out all of the, you know, magazines aimed at girls, like, you know, Jackie and Oh Boy. And, you know, if they couldn't get a copy which had a Squeeze poster in from one of their friends after they'd read it, they'd go and buy me a copy. And then, you know, they'd rip out the center spread and send it to me, you know, laughing that I probably didn't want the rest of the magazine. And so, yeah, I built up some real friendships with really nice, caring people. You know, I'd go looking for rare records for them. We'd share all the news and, you know, experiences of going to the band's gigs and write each other long letters. And I had one friend who just found out every band member's address, their mum and dad's address, would, you know, go and visit the properties, would find out their telephone numbers, would, you know, ring me up from a payphone and tell me they just found out what car Chris was driving and, you know, what its registration number was. And, you know, it's funny to think now that, you know, she joined the police service. But it should have been obvious to me at the time. And so, you know, I was there. June, who was Julian's mum, answered my letters and said, look, I'm getting loads of queries from fans about how to find their records. You know more about this than anyone else. You know, would you be prepared to just answer a few letters for me? Yeah, you know, because you know what to say. And I said, yes, of course, you know, just send them along. And she said, well, I'll always ask them to send in, you know, the postage, send in a stamped addressed envelope. And then if you could, it'd save me a huge amount of time. So right from 1979, you know, the band, Julian's mum was getting me to, you know, write to fans, support the band, help people find their records. So I remember one summer, I was incredibly bored. And I thought, well, I'm going to try and find out what records have been released by Squeeze all over the world. You know, I knew that there were different singles in America. And I thought that was absolutely fascinating. So I phoned up A&M Records in the King's Road from the home phone and said, you know, hello, I'm record consultant, the official Squeeze fan club, because Jules's mum had said I could call myself that. I wondered if you could give me the address of every A&M Records in the world, please. And, you know, they laughed and said, well, you know, which countries? And I said, all of them. You know, I've got my piece of paper here. So they gave me the addresses. And I wrote long, I created my own name. I created my own headed note paper. I got all the addresses. I wrote to each individual there saying, I'm interested in finding out what Squeeze records have been released where. You know, if you could send me a full catalogue, you know, preferably send me, you know, copies of the singles. But, you know, went to the post office, put the right postage on for Japan, Australia, Canada, France, Germany. And I remember I was at work. I had a Saturday job and my mum phoned me to say, you've got parcel after parcel here. And I was so beside myself with excitement. My boss let me leave work early. And, you know, I'd just been sent 26 records from Paris, France, with, you know, albums and, you know, singles that are only released in Denmark and, you know, promotional biographies. And, you know, I got stuff from all over the world. And so that was, you know, the beginning of my collection, really. So it was hardly any surprise when you know, I set up a business and got a marketing qualification and created logos and business names and wrote persuasive letters. You know, I've had lots of education, you know, lots of O levels and A levels, and, you know, got a degree and postgraduate, you know, qualifications, but nothing was as useful as loving Squeeze and, you know, playing about with my hobby to train me as a, you know, 15-year-old how to do that.
Well, it's interesting because there are many parallels to what a lot of people nowadays went through back with the Beatles and sort of the work that they put in voluntarily for the fan clubs back in the day. And that led to, no matter it seemed what kind of education or path they led in life, those sort of beginnings of being responsible and taking the initiative on something that really is just a passion project, but you were entrusted with it, led to a lifelong career, you know, kind of pushed you forward because you took such an interest as a teenager, you know, in something that, you know, you invested so much of your time with. So I think that that's pretty cool. I mean, when you went to the gigs, what was the atmosphere like there? Were there people that you had continually met and then you would say, I'm going to be at this Squeeze gig, and you just followed the band to certain, you know, venues that time?
Yeah. Well, the first one I went to in Manchester, the capacity, Manchester Apollo, was probably about 3,000. And I think they'd probably sold about 500 tickets. And so the date had already been cancelled once because they delayed the entire tour to try and finish recording Argy Bargy, and it had overrun. And they'd broken down on the way to the venue on the motorway. So they arrived late. It was November in Manchester, and absolutely persisting it down. I was like a drowned rat outside. It was freezing cold. We were left for hours. And, you know, the atmosphere was terrible in the gig. You know, it was, you know, they'd sold 1 in 6 tickets. The band were moody because they'd, you know, broken down and been on the motorway for hours. And, yeah, so the atmosphere was terrible. You know, but people in Manchester didn't like them because they're a London band. And, you know, none of my friends liked them because they thought they were Cockneys. And, but they played incredibly well. It was a transcendent moment. But from then on, I started travelling the country. All my, you know, Squeeze pen friends, the, you know, normally slightly older girls, were really welcoming. You know, they'd invite me down. I'd get the train as a 15, 16-year-old, you know, 5 hours across the country, you know, sleep on their lounge floor, do the tourist bit around London, go to London gigs, and then I got invited to backstage parties. I was there with the country's first million-pound footballer and soccer player to you, having a great time. I mean, the first time I met the band, I was just going to see them, but a pen friend, Justine, begged me, please come along with me. I need to meet the band. Will you stand on a street corner with me? So I thought I'd be gallant and meet up with her at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, stand on a Manchester street corner. And we spotted them arrive in a minibus. So I waved and said hello, pointed to my squeezed T-shirt, went over there, Glenn wound the window down, and I couldn't believe how polite he was and how interested in meeting us. And I said, this is Justine, she's desperate to meet you, come and say hello. And we chatted for 5 minutes, and they'd gone to the wrong car park and had to drive off. So the incident said, get on the bus. So, the first time I met them, we got on the tour bus, carried on chatting, went backstage, carried on chatting. There's a curly sandwich and a warm can of Double Diamond, which I think was lager. I won't tell you what it tasted like. And, they just adopted me as a, and looked after me as a young fan, fed me, watered me. Chatted to me, were incredibly, kind, looked at the collection and records that I'd brought along. So, yeah, they've always been really nice. They're decent people, always treated me with respect. And, from then, I remember I went to London and met up with Julian's mum, June, and she took me out to the pub, Royal Standard in Blackheath, and bought me my very first pint of beer. Illegally, I was only 16 and not having a meal, but she didn't seem to mind. Went to her house, and her twins, Julian's younger brothers, were rehearsing in the front room. So yeah, it was lovely. I felt I had a calling. I had friends. I had a whole social network. It was, being a fan of Squeeze was not something I did. It was something I was.
Would you say that there were a very few of you that would really kind of have started and have just gone through any iteration of Squeeze? Because I'm imagining, it would take a lot to sort of hang with them as long as you can, thinking this is a band that's going to make it, they're going to be huge. But what was it within you that felt this is a band that I could really stay with no matter through thick and thin?
Well, I think I after buying Take Me, I'm Yours, I didn't even know Bang Bang had come out. So it was Goodbye Girl that I bought next. And, I thought, this is absolute genius. Whoever's writing this music, telling these stories, is breathtaking. So I instantly went out and bought the first album before any other. And the first album became my favourite album. So I feel really lucky, really privileged for Squeeze to be my favourite band on the basis of the first album. Before Call for Cats came out, before Up the Junction came out. So when Up the Junction, Call for Cats, when I got that album, it just became part of who I was. And, as far as Up to the Junction's concerned, it is Van Gogh's Sunflowers. It is the Pantheon in ancient Rome. It is the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. It is one of the greatest works of art, which will still be talked about and revered in 1,000 years. And for two young blokes in their early 20s from South London to have created something utterly timeless like that, says an awful lot about, you know, them and the time that they managed to harness, I think. Does that make sense?
Because would you also say too that it just happened not only for Chris and Glenn, but it also happened like at the right time as far as what was going on within Britain, maybe?
Yeah, I think if you listen to what Squeeze sounded like live in 1975 and 1976, because there were, you know, reasonable audio recordings of, you know, their live gigs in pubs and clubs. You know, there's a live recording of Gilson's very first gig with the band. And they're a heavy R&B band. You know, they sound like, you know, Dr. Feelgood, Nine Below Zero. They're a leather jacket, rhythm and blues numbers, 3 minutes, you know, a mixture of, you know, Glenn singing, Elvis Presley, you know, covers with, you know, doing an Elvis impression, which is hilarious. Or, you know, a mixture of their own songs or songs that, you know, Chris had written on his own, and, you know, a few Beatles numbers. But it's, you know, it's heavy, loud, rhythm and blues music. And, you know, what was around in, you know, mid-70s before punk and new wave was, you know, Rick Wakeman and, you know, his dozen keyboards, and, you know, everything had to be done by professional musicians and massively overproduced, and they were just masters of the 3 minute pop song and did it with a huge amount of energy. So, you know, they were never a punk band, but they had that in common.
Right, because I felt like reading that history at that time that there just wasn't a lot of, you know, it was hard to scrape together a band, more or less. You know, you just had what you had, and if you had if you were lucky enough to have a job, that's what you bought with your money was, you know, your gear, if I may say so. And then getting the gigs in the smaller venues, would you say that that was lending itself to you know, sort of like a hometown kind of crowd? Had you sort of experienced that when you went around and saw those early gigs?
Yeah, well, I didn't see the really early gigs. You know, 1979 was my first one. But in the early days, you know, most of the members of Squeeze had jobs. You know, the band was what they did in the evenings. You know, they spent, you know, 4 years together before they managed to, you know, get a record out, you know, slogging around with all their equipment in, you know, borrowed cars or, you know, a manager's van. You know, I found that there were lots of, you know, there were loads of fans like me. You know, I'm not in any way special. Every one of the band members had at least 5 girls outside the flat at all times. Desperate to chat and, you know, get their records signed and have photos taken.
Besides being able to see them live and experience them live, what was that first experience like seeing them on the television, which I imagine, did that happen when Cool for Cats came out?
It did. I saw them first when Take Me Home Yours was on. They're on Top of the Pops twice. In 1978, and then once again, but only as the play out music with the audience dancing at the end. And yeah, I just lived every moment of it as if it was the very first experience, as if I'd been newly born, as if these were, you know, the first sensations in a strange world. You know, I just couldn't get close enough to the TV. And, you know, watching every expression, every note that was played. I adored it. I've never been someone who's selfish or thinking that it's my band. So I want the whole world to appreciate Squeeze and for it to become a bit of their personality as well. The more the merrier. So, you know, I've been to Squeeze gigs where they don't know I'm there. I've got a ticket. It's the very back of the auditorium. I sit there and chat to the fans beforehand, leave at the end. That's all fine by me. You know, I just want to be a fan and experience it.
So let me ask you, because, Julian figures so heavily early on with you, especially on a personal level, and his mother, what was your feeling, do you remember back then, as you may or may not have started to witness that Julian wanted to leave Squeeze?
Yeah, the first big breakup, really, that I was aware of. Yeah, it's heartbreaking, yeah. Heartbreaking, the thought that someone who is so integral to the band, to their look, to their on-stage persona, because he had always been, often quite quiet, and just playing, boogie-woogie along to, their songs. But, later on, by 1980, he was an essential part of who the band were, how you felt about the band, because a lot of the early reviews of Squeeze, they criticised the band for having no stage presence. A band just arrived and played fast 3-minute numbers one after another and then disappeared with minimal chat. And the music papers hated them. The NME was the enemy, as far as I was concerned, and so was Sounds. And the Melody Maker didn't really get it either. That Squeeze weren't a political band, weren't punk, and therefore were to be hated. And the music papers just wrote about how much they hated the sort of people who went to see a band like that, rather than actually talking about the music. Julian became an essential part. Something snapped on an American tour, and he just started doing 10-minute long monologues over misadventure, introducing the bands, talking nonsense, making it all up, insulting the audience, being just hilarious. All that extemporizing was genius. It was a major loss to the onstage persona. They're always going to be different after Julian are left. But little did we know they'd go and make an even better album next.
Exactly. The weird part is, and I don't know your perspective on it, so what happened was with the U.S., I feel like Argy Bargy was a little bit under the radar. It would be like you'd have to be a dedicated Squeeze knower of things to have gone to have seen them at that time. And we had various incarnations across the United States of what was then called music videos. So the launch of MTV, which happened in the summer of 1981, and then it kind of started from New York City, where it was based, outward to the rest of the states, the first viewing that we had of Squeeze as a band was with Paul Carrack. So it was almost like we were starting from scratch. We didn't know who Jules was. And we saw this kind of soulful band that kind of just kind of stroll out and took it easy. And you had a semi-familiar voice singing the song. And so that was sort of the United States mass market introduction to the band. So did you, were you aware of that kind of perception? I mean, other than the fact of now we know in hindsight what was going on and who was helping them and who Paul was, what was your initial thoughts? Do you remember back when that all happened?
I do, yeah. It's interesting because a lot of people grew up with music, TV. And I really missed out on all of that. I had no TV at all from 1982 till 1990. So, I'm not someone who has any memories of Squeeze on TV. I don't associate any of the music with videos. I never watched MTV. And so that's a whole other world of Squeeze fandom. So, for instance, I've got all the greatest hits of Squeeze on DVD multiple times every time they've come out on, including VHS, PAL, NTSC, a DVD. But, I've probably watched their videos twice, and that's it. If you ask me what a video to one of their songs is like, I probably wouldn't know. I'd have to go and watch it. So for me, it was an entirely musical journey. But yeah, I was well aware, because I had American pen friends as well, who started trading cassettes with me and would photocopy, undercover photocopying missions at work, would photocopy things like Trouser Press and Rolling Stone. So I'd get all of the interviews and a real understanding of how they were viewed stateside. So yeah, I did understand that they're a completely different band to other people, which was great. It just meant I always had a different perspective to talk about with people who are fans.
It's understandable too, because it feels very Americanized when you talk about music television and the pervasiveness of this network just kind of plowed over everybody. It was just like blanketed after about a year. And it was the persistence of being able to get a lot of those bands from England who had already had music videos available. And I think that's what really, if I'm trying to put it in a nutshell for early MTV, was that that's how they were able to make that big break is, to be honest, MTV still was not, fully national. They needed videos to play, and they played them over and over and over and over and over again. So Tempted just kind of was able to be one of those lucky few that were able to be on nearly 24/7 at that time. Yeah. So I, in a weird way, for, someone of my generation, I graduated high school in 1982. I was 18 in 1982. So that's kind of where my standing with Squeeze was. I was like, this is a band that, keeps getting played all the time. And to be honest, like you said, talking about the music press, it was totally different here, because the music press was very, very receptive, although they did tend to pigeonhole them a little bit. Yeah. Even after, say, getting into the Madison Square Garden later in 82, but reading a lot of that early press in the United States, they were still considered, for what America was looking at them from that prism, was new wave. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's always strange when American fans start talking about the Knack and Squeeze as natural bedfellows. As far as I'm concerned, all of that's marketing. You can call music whatever you want. You can talk about it at length. You can write, books and articles all you want. But basically, music's for listening to. And you get an emotional and intellectual response to it if it speaks to you and it becomes part of your very, very soul. So, yeah, it's just a whole load of marketing and not really who they are. Squeeze could have been so many different bands if they'd had a different record company, if they'd had a different manager, if they'd had a different girlfriends at the time, if they hadn't had a chance meeting with someone else. If you look at Glenn's demos, or I was lucky enough to go into Universal's archives and listen to a lot of the recordings that have never been released. The Call for Cats album was completed and submitted and rejected outright. Yeah. And they had to go back in the studio and re-record the whole thing. And the album didn't include Call for Cats or Up the Junction. So, if that album had come out, we'd just think of them completely differently. So yeah, it's all just an accident, really, how they're perceived and how people talk about them. There could have been so many other different bands, but they happened to get the collections of songs that they released released and got well known for, you know, being in a time and place, called lots of things like New Wave, but I really don't take that, you know, seriously. You know, they write beautiful lyrics, incredible melodies, and would have been hugely successful either on their own or together in any time in the last 70 years.
I totally agree, because it feels like you'd remembered that, you know, this is a band who writes, you know, if you put it in, you know, a nutshell, quality material. And we're trying to think back to the time period that the marketing aspect of the band took place, which was during that time period. And you're thinking of all these other bands that started up. And we always say it, you know, they were hair bands like Flock of Seagulls and Duran Duran and Spandau Ballet. And they all had a presence here, but that really wasn't due to a lot of airplay, to be honest. It wasn't due to a lot of material selling of an album or a single at that time. So we had it skewed a little bit differently, whereas I feel your country, and despite the fact, you know, obviously they came from the UK, that there was a more personal investment in this band, where it meant something to go out and see them, and it meant something to go out and purchase their music at that time, and therefore you felt invested, whereas we were just, hey, there's this new cute lead singer or this cute guy in the band. He's got blonde hair. His name is Glenn Telbrock. And then it kind of just got, you know, glossed over a bit. And then it really hit hard with Sweets from a Stranger, where they do a video, which, you know, they actually, honestly, and Chris told me, hate.
You know? Well, they weren't interested in style. They weren't interested in clothes. They weren't interested in acting. They weren't interested in visuals. They're songwriters who love being in a, you know, a band, a live band, and playing together. So, you know, it's difficult to get them enthralled by doing something, especially when, you know, the Black Coffee in Bed video was actually recorded when they didn't know the cameras were rolling. You know, they had a,
absolutely right.
They had a board run through, after which they said, right, thank you. When are we going to film it? We've done it. We've got all we need. I was lucky that after Jules left, and my natural connection with the band through him and June, his mum, went, that Chris Difford's brother was associated with the band. You know, he was their accountant. So he instantly got me in as a volunteer. So I went to work before I went to uni, after finishing school, went to work for the band for a week. They put me up in a hotel in South Kensington. I commuted every day to Putney, went in their management offices and did all the filing, all the photocopying, owned all the posts, went to the post office, chatted to the manager, you know, David Enthoven, who then went on to manage Brian Ferry, Roxy Music, and some bloke who was in Take That, who became a megastar. What's his name? Yeah. So I went
Robbie
there.
Williams?
That's the one. He managed Robbie Williams. So I chatted with him and helped them plan a tour. I did the letter to fans, inviting people who were members of the fan club to come along to Hitchin, the Regal Theatre, to see the band play. And it was a simulcast. So it was on Radio 2 in FM and live on BBC TV on, I think, a bank holiday weekend. So I was involved in planning to get the fans to come along and giving them free tickets. So we got an absolutely mental audience. I'm in the front row in a white shirt, absolutely drenched in sweat, having the most fantastic time. For that concert. So yeah, that's how I sort of, you know, started really early, just volunteering to help. And exactly the same happened 18 years ago when I took redundancy from a full-time job and started being self-employed. And I only had about one day's work a week self-employed, and I needed to do something about that. So I thought, I need to learn some new skills. I need to build myself a business website. That's what I need, a business website. I'm going to do it myself. So I thought, well, I can't, it's too high risk to build that as my first one. I'll build another website. What can I possibly build a website for just as a dummy run?
Here's what I found.
And I thought, well, I'll build a squeeze website. I'll get packetof3.com and I'll put my collection up there. And from that point on, you know, band members, families, fans just came out of the woodwork, started writing to me, posting me CDs, sending me photos. And, you know, everyone loved, you know, looking back. So from that point on, I was, you know, running the website. And from that, Universal Records got me involved in the reissues of the CDs. So, you know, when the four reissues came out, they amazingly, how about this as a dream volunteering job for a fan? Universal Music sent me a database of every tape they hold my squeeze. I was able to call up any of them from storage. They employed two engineers for my personal use. They hired in a tape-to-tape, you know, reel-to-reel player and put it in a studio for me. I went to London. We had to bake the tapes in a low oven overnight so that the oxide didn't shed from the old tape media. And then I could hear audio that had never been played in, you know, over 40 years for the very first time in multi-track. And I could say to the engineer, can I just hear the backing vocals to find out what they're actually saying in Pulling Muscles? Ah, right, it's suntan lotion, it's deck chair attendant. Okay, yeah, I'd always wondered that. You know, what a dream job. And then I could write the sleeve notes, and then I could work with the designer to come up with creative ideas for the CD booklets. And yeah, it was an absolute dream. So yeah, it's been a lifetime journey, really, right from my, you know, first invitation from Jules's mum to help out, to being in the studio with Universal, just being useful, I think, is what I've been.
That must have been, I want to backtrack a second, because that must have just been mind-blowing, like how it was with Get Back and the Beatles, where you have like the minutiae, the granular moments that you've never heard before, and being able to hear that, that must have been a mind blow. I was wondering too, like, how did the choice get made to do the particular releases that you worked on?
That was all my suggestion. So, you know, they came up with the albums, and, you know, I suggested not doing them in chronological order, doing a mixture, having one out of the four, which would be a double CD. The same sort of thing happened when Glenn had all his demos from all of the years. He got in contact and said, I want to put my demos out. I was just going to bung them on four CDs. Could you have a listen and tell me what you think? So he sent me six CDs full of all his demos, some of which I'd heard before, because, you know, band members had played them to me. And so I was able to say, no, they've got to come out in five CDs. This is the order. You know, don't release those. Fans wouldn't like them. This one isn't on the list, but it's a definite, it's stunning. And here's the titles. You know, you call this one Dreams Are Made of This. call the other one the pasta's been bottled. You know, so just being useful, being around. One of the useful things, I think, is that I've never, ever wanted anything from them. And, you know, because I've helped out with their social media occasionally in the early days. You know, if they want to go on holiday and they, you know, need to maintain it. And just every day, there's a whole bunch of people who want stuff from them. You know, they want stuff signed. They want a charity gig. They want to put their live recording up. They want to charge for their DVD. They want to... And it's so draining, so incredibly draining for a band to have to face that the whole time. Whereas, you know, I didn't care about any of that stuff. You know, if they want me, they know where I am. I'll always be useful. And I don't need or want anything from them. So I think that helped them be able to, you know, just trust me. Yeah, I know loads of stuff that I'd never, ever tell anyone. I've got lots of music that I can't possibly share with anyone. But I share as much as I possibly can to, you know, share the squeeze love. Does that make sense?
It's interesting. Yeah, because it's going to be interesting with back in 2014, and of course, this is something the American audiences weren't privy to, was that those gigs that Glenn and Chris did, sort of the At Odds tour, which was more like a celebration, I guess, of their 40 years together. Can you give me a little bit of how that all felt? I mean, did you get a chance to go to those gigs?
Yes, yeah. I always go to as many gigs as I can in the tour. So the last tour they did, it was quite light. I went to four gigs out of the tour. Generally, what I do is go to the one in Manchester so I can stay with my parents and look after them a bit. Go to the one in Oxford because that's where my best mate lives and I can take him along to the gig and we can go out and have a great time. Go to a local one here in Devon, and you know, my cycling buddy and neighbour will go to that, and then often try and get to a, you know, big London one and meet up with the other fans. So yeah, the At Odds tour was great. I think it was different because you know, it was a duo and it was heavily staged, so you know, they were in their pyjamas. They started the gig in an actual bed together. They did do solo material as well as squeeze material. So it was unusual, really, for them to do that because something that's, I don't know, perhaps people don't know this, but Glenn isn't a nostalgia artist. He's not into appearing on 80s revival tours. As far as he's concerned, he hasn't produced his best music yet. And he's a living, breathing musician who loves modern influences, who's listening to every bit of modern experimental music. And although it might not appear to come out in what he writes with Chris, it's all influencing him. So, yeah, it was nice to get, I don't know, a little bit of nostalgia for the fans to do a, you know, a joint celebration rather than just being, you know, we've got to have a new material, new album. We're not relying, you know, not resting on our laurels, not relying on our singles, 45s and under. But you know, they're still a band that's creative and happening now.
And it really showed, actually, when I saw them in 2021, that they were able to. And again, they're sort of appealing, you know, to my age group because, you know, we're the that population that sort of, in quotations, grew up with them. But I ran into a few people that were in their 20s, mm-hmm. That were aware of them as far as even newer music, you know, had maybe made the entry point in 91 or something, you know, they had play, or Some Fantastic Place. And then later on, it's now just, it is a name, but people want to hear them. They really, really want to make that connection. So it was good that, you know, that Food for Thought came out and sort of kept them like, wow, this is a band that's making great music. They don't have to be, like you said, and what Glenn despises as far as nostalgia, kind of throwback types of appearances. So that was really just super nice. I mean, we're all kind of anticipating, what's it going to sound like? What's it going to sound like? But they've got a great band too. They've got a solid band as a unit playing together. I would guess that's just helped so much. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think the band they've got now is the most professional band they've ever had. And that's a great thing because, you know, Glenn has, real consummate musicians who are taking his compositions incredibly seriously and playing exactly what he wants them to play. Which, you know, is what he's been striving for all of these years. You know, they've got a set list, and you know, a few of the tracks are done to click tracks, because you know Simon's such an incredible character, such a powerful drummer. He does get excited and sometimes speeds up, so you know we have to restrain him from that joyous enthusiasm.
You have to do that to him?
we do just the tiniest bit to keep a perfect pace so that everyone else can keep up. So yeah, it's the most professional outfit they've had. You know, it's different in that there's less capacity for devilment. You know, Glenn, especially towards the end of a tour, in times gone by, would really start to stretch things out, would start doing a different song, would throw in an incredible solo, would every other band member would be hanging on his every guitar note to wonder where on earth the song was going next. And so there's sort of slightly less of that creative chaos and extension of songs, all that sort of thing. But it does sound better than it's ever sounded before. I still absolutely adore seeing them. And, you know, it's a religious experience. You know, the feeling of absolute ecstasy of being beside myself when one of my favorite songs comes on, when they play Wicked and Cruel, I'm just there, my heart's about to burst, and I feel, oh, my eyes are going all wet, this is just incredible to be here and witness it. So it's been a lovely thing to spend a lifetime doing, and I'm so grateful that they're still there, still fit, still talking to one another, still commercially able to fill, all of the big and medium-sized venues, and still have new people coming to them, discovering, what a wealth of music and songwriting and storytelling there is. So I've been very, very lucky. I chose well when I turned on that transistor radio and the opening bars of Take Me I'm Yours came on in February 1978.
I absolutely agree with you, and I'm so happy that you were able to join me and kind of reminisce and give your unique insight into this band. So thank you for coming in and for going into this chat with me. I appreciate it.
No, my pleasure. One final anecdote. Please. In the late 70s, early 80s, probably early 80s, I'm such a keen fan, and my social life revolved around the band, that I remember my brother saying to me, quite seriously, when it was just the two of us, he said, "Do you know, Dave, I think you take this Squeeze thing a bit too far sometimes." and I know he's only trying to be helpful. But I remember looking at him and feeling absolutely outraged. And I said to him, "Oh, you do you?" And I said, "Well, I think I'll be a grey-haired old man, and I'll still think Squeeze are my favourite band, and Take Me, I'm Yours will still be the greatest thing that's ever been recorded." And, yeah, I still agree.
And you're the grey-haired, still thinking that Take Me, I'm Yours is the greatest thing ever.
And they are the greatest band that have ever existed, yeah.
Agreed.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you, Amy. Thanks very much for inviting me on. I've really enjoyed listening to the other episodes. And yeah, the very best of luck. Squeeze belong to everyone. And I'm delighted that you're helping spread the word.
Thank you so much. It means a lot. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.